to the cloud. Okay.
Right, okay then. So today we are looking at what I'm calling the Corinthian correspondence, which obviously means letters, but actually more than letters. It involves everything that happened in and around Paul's visits to Corinth, the letters he wrote, the reports that came back, the other people that were sent, and so on. So there's going to be quite a bit of Bible reading today, probably more reading than me talking, which isn't a bad thing. And if you feel that a map would be useful to see where places are, then do try and get one of those ready in front of you. So we're going to start by looking at Acts chapter 18, verses 1 to 17. That's Acts 18, verses 1 to 17. So for the next 2 minutes, please read through those verses, and then I'll start to talk about them and where we go on from there. So Acts 18, the first 17 verses. Now, I'm never a very good judge of how quickly people read, so I think I've probably given you long enough for 17 verses, but obviously you can keep looking at them. So this tells you about Paul's first visit to Corinth. I know you've been muted, but I would like to be able to answer questions, so can we find a way of unmuting as and when necessary?
Yes, people can just press the button and...
So the first question is, where did Paul actually come from? Where had he been before he went there?
Is he in Athens?
Athens, that's right. Okay. Have you ever wondered why you never read in the Bible Paul's letter to the church or the saints at Athens? Why isn't there a letter from Paul to the church at Athens then, if that's where he was? A very simple answer. He didn't plant a church there. he didn't find it easy. He didn't get any real sort of success there. You know, we often think about Paul, the great missionary, the great evangelist, the great apostle. Everywhere he went, everything was wonderful and marvellous and great success, massive converts and so on. He had very little fruit in Athens, to be honest. I think he tried to engage with them, but there was not enough to actually establish a church there. So when he moved on, to Corinth, which is only about 40 miles away, I think, something like that. He probably was a bit discouraged, a bit dejected about what had happened. And he actually says in his letter, first letter to them, that when he first went, he was there in much weakness, fear, and trembling. So a little bit about Corinth, first of all, just in case you're not familiar with this. But if you've got a map, you'll see that it's in the southern part of Greece, a place, a region called, if I pronounce it right, Achaia. And Corinth was actually the capital of that particular area. Apparently it takes its name from a type of grape or currant there. I think I believe that, but anyway, Corinth from Corinth, but that's probably how it got its name. It was a very large city of the time, population probably approximately 100,000, very prosperous, except that a third of them were slaves. And Corinth was used as a market town for buying and selling slaves as they were then moved onwards, mainly westwards. It was a Roman colony. It therefore had Roman architecture, Latin as an official language, but it was also, of course, in a Greek setting with Greek gods, as well as the imperial cult. There was also a quite significant and long-standing Jewish community there. And then that community grew when the Jews were expelled from Rome, which was in the time of the Emperor Claudius. Again, if you've got a map there, you'll see that actually it's on a very narrow strip of land. It's called an isthmus, that sort of bit of land, as you head south into this region of Greece. It's on a tiny little isthmus, which is only about 4 or 5 miles wide. But it was very multicultural, commercial centre, and it loved to cater to people who were visiting or passing through, terms of food and entertainment, and that means lots of taverns and also lots of, should we say, brothels, places for prostitutes. It was also a place where the socially ambitious would gather. Many opportunities there for social advance, prosperity, but equally it had a reputation for sexual immorality, luxury and self-promotion. In fact, Corinth was a byword for immorality, and a word was eventually coined to Corinthianize, which actually meant to engage in fornication. So its name became attached to the things that it was sort of famous for. But it was very wealthy, mainly from two things, manufacturing bronze and the Isthmian Games. Now, you've all heard of the Olympic Games, obviously. But the Isthmian Games, named after the isthmus that it was on, was the second largest sports event. And in fact, it was held twice a year. So it's very frequent. So they used it really for tourism and trade and so on. And the games were held in honour of Poseidon, perhaps because being an isthmus, the sea was next to it, you know, maybe. And the chances are that the Isthmian Games were actually going on when Paul arrived, and the year is AD 51, if you want to put some kind of historical context into that. Incidentally, any idea how old Paul would be by the time he arrived there? Any idea about Paul's age? Anyone got any thoughts on how old this man was by the time he was going around in his second journey?
Was he a young man? I think he was, isn't he?
No, he's knocking on a bit by then.
Oh.
Well, he'd probably be late 40s. By the time we get towards the end of this little story of all his doings and throwings with the Corinthian church, he's probably hit 50.
They're really young.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that depends how you define old and young these days. But in those days, it probably was. It was a very competitive city. It was actually the first Greek city to have Roman gladiatorial contests. And something that is going to prove to be important or significant later on was that it took part in one of the great sort of social building blocks of the Greco-Roman society, which was the idea of the patron-client relationship. Now, the patron-client relationship, a little bit like we think of as patrons today, perhaps, but this is a bit more so. Those that were wealthy, the more well-to-do citizens, became the benefactors of others who became, therefore, their clients, in the sense of the patrons offered advice, maybe money, maybe protection to the clients, in return for which the client offered various services, maybe helping out in the family or campaigning for various things or whatever. In other words, relationships were built up between the better off and the worse off. And in that sense, the client became almost beholden to his patron who had done him this favour, maybe helping him with his business or his work in some way. So most of the converts that's going to make up the church in Corinth would actually be from the poorer end of society. There were a few that were part of the more elite, but most of the converts there were going to be quite poor. Now, from your reading, did you notice how long Paul stayed there? Have a look through that passage again. He was there quite a while.
A year and a half.
Yeah, 18 months.
More than that, because that was once he'd moved next door.
Yeah. Well, he says that he stayed there for a year and a half. Oh, but you mean that he'd been there a little while before then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, maybe. I don't know how long that before would be, but we know from later dates that it won't have been a lot more than that anyway. And who did he meet there? Significant people. Who did he meet?
Aquila and Priscilla.
Yeah. And how come they were there?
Because they were expelled from Rome.
That's right. They were part of the Jewish community that had been kicked out of Rome by Claudius. So Paul meets them there for the first time. And what do they have in common with Paul?
Tent makers.
They also made tents, exactly.
And prayer shawls.
And what, sorry?
Prayer shawls.
As well as tents?
No, it probably was prayer shawls rather than tents.
Well, really?
Yep.
Do you mean
that's what... Where have gone, Christine?
This is... right, I'll read you the note in here.
What's here?
One new man.
Okay.
Prayer shawl making required special training that all three had. The word skenopoi, translated prayer shawl makers or tent makers, is not found anywhere else in scripture or secular Greek writing. Jewish men referred to the prayer shawl as the tent or prayer closet. Yes, it was over the head to shield the eyes while praying. Whole load of stuff in the glossary about it as
okay.
well.
Okay, so what we're saying there is that the translation is a little ambiguous because it's not a very well-known word.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so Paul might have made tents, he might have made prayer shawls, he might have made both. But you're saying the idea of the prayer shawl, because you cover yourself with it, you put it yeah. over your head. Yeah. That it becomes yes, tent-like.
Yes, it okay. was referred to as a tent.
Many yeah. Jews do call it a tent, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, as it's not found anywhere else in secular Greek writing, if it was just a tent, any other
you'd think you probably would, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, whatever they actually did, they were tent makers like Paul. I mean, I know it makes sense from the Jewish point of view, but it's also a profession, for want of a better word, that you could do wherever you went. If you was going to a place like Corinth, there was a good Jewish community there, so it would make sense that they could make a living that way. But also, of course, there'd be lots of visitors there, and this is the point I was going to make, was that if you have a lot of temporary visitors, particularly for a big event like the Games, then again, making temporary shelters would be a good thing to do. Now, who actually also joins him while he's there? Two other people turn up.
Silas and Timothy.
Yeah. So they eventually join him. And I don't know if it actually mentions this, but Silas has come from Philippi. Again, if you've got a map, you'll be able to see what sort of journey that's like. And he seems to be bringing a gift. I don't mean he was an apparition or something. But he was bringing a gift from Philippi.
P-H-I-L.
And Timothy had come from Thessalonica. And he had brought Paul some news from Thessalonica, from the church there, because Paul had previously been to Thessalonica. And there's a sort of mixture of good news and bad news. He said they were standing firm. They'd been persecuted, but they were standing firm. But some of them were tempted to return to their pagan past. And some of them had questions concerning something that was now happening, which was that believers were now dying. So they had questions about what is actually happening if our fellow believers are dying. What happens to them, what happens to us, sort of thing. And so Paul writes to them, and this is now AD 51, which is when he arrives. So he writes 1 Thessalonians, what we call 1 Thessalonians. So that's written from Corinth. So while he's there, Paul does some preaching. He preaches in the synagogues, as was the usual way. But you notice that he was opposed by a lot of the Jews, and there was also opposition, as well as some success. Who does it mention there in particular that he had, shall we say, success with converts?
Crispus?
Yeah, and who was Crispus?
The leader of the synagogue.
Yeah, that's right. And another guy who I think lived nearby or next door even.
Titus Justus.
Yes, Gaius Titius Justus, his full name. So, from preaching in the synagogue, he had some success. That's the name of some of the others that were eventually going to meet there. Stephanus and his whole household, I think was probably the first one. Erastus was the city treasurer, and Gaius Titius Justus was a Roman citizen. He may have been a God-fearer, but he was certainly well-to-do, and he had a large enough home next to the synagogue that Paul could then use for his ministry and his gatherings.
But were they all either Roman or Gentile?
Well, they might have been. well, the guy who was the Crispus, if he was the synagogue ruler, he would have been Jewish. They may have had Roman citizenship as well, because it was a Roman colony. But if you remember, if the Jews opposed him, Paul said, from now on I'll go to the Gentiles. So some of them may well have been Gentiles. But like Paul himself, they probably had a Gentile name as or a Greek name as well as a Jewish name. And Paul baptizes some of them, but not all of them. Baptizes Crispus, Gaius and Stephanus. I don't know the answer to that question anymore in terms of exactly how many were Jewish, how many were Gentile at that point, I'm afraid. But we've got some names there. The guy with the large home next to the synagogue, these large homes would actually hold about 50 or 60 people, maybe a bit of a squash, but you really could have meetings there. That could well be the beginning of your house church there. Used. Okay, so let's now have a read of some passages from 1 Corinthians. I know we haven't got to the letter bit yet, but there's some interesting facts there. So have a read of 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5, and chapter 3, verses 1 to 6, and verse 10. So 1 Corinthians 2, 1 to 5, and 1 Corinthians 3, 1 to 6, and 10. Or you can just read on from 1 to 10 if you really want. In these verses, Paul is explaining what it was like when he was with them, when he came to them. And that's where he says he came in weakness and fear and much trembling. He also explains in chapter 3 how he was effectively just laying a foundation and he couldn't really go much further because they were very worldly, mere infants, so they only got as far as the milk stage. We'll look at one or two of the other things about Apollos later, but let me get to verse 10. He's saying, I laid a foundation. And that was after 18 months. So again, let's not assume that everything was immediately rosy and golden for Paul. Also, while he's there at this time, he took a temporary Nazarite vow. Last time we looked at Samson and worked out what a Nazarite really was like, and you can do this as a temporary thing. Apparently he lets his hair grow while he's there. He does it as a token of thanksgiving to God that he's having some success. And also while he's there, he gets a response back from Thessalonica, his first letter, where he realizes that they haven't quite got it. They've misunderstood quite a bit of what he was writing about, so he has to write again. So we get 2 Thessalonians written around about AD 52. Now, if you remember, Silas brought him a gift from Philippi, which helped. But that money didn't last for all that time, which is probably why he was doing some, I'll call it tent making still, but making stuff anyway, using his hands, working like any good teacher stroke rabbi would do in those days. And one thing he refused to do was to accept any money from the Corinthian converts. He would accept money from somewhere he'd been to before and was sent on to him, but he never wanted to receive money from the place where he was at. He says, lest I be a burden to you. But remember what I've said about the patron-client relationship. Once you started receiving money, particularly from more well-to-do people, it could at least be seen as they were your patrons, you were your clients. And he didn't want to give that impression at all, because if that was the case, then his patron could tell him more what to do. like, you don't go till I say so, or you now do this, you now do that. And he never wanted to be linked in with anybody, as sort of beholden to them, because he'd received money under this sort of patronage system. Anyway, there is this opposition. They accuse him of various things. He stays there a little longer, and eventually he moves on. So we're now back in Acts. So turn back to Acts 18 and verses 18 to 23. And I've also put down chapter 19, verse 1 and verse 10. So Acts 18, picking it up from where you left off, 18 to 23, and on into chapter 19, verses 1 and 10. The two little verses in chapter 19 is just so we can pick up the story in a minute from there. Do you notice something you did before you set sail?
He cut his hair.
That's right. his temporary vow came to an end. He decided that that was only for that time while he was there. And he says is it Kenkria? That's the way you pronounce it, Kenkria, Senkria. Again, if you've got a map, you'll see that that's right next to Corinth. In fact, it's actually the seaport that goes with Corinth. So it's part of the same place, really. It's where you set sail from. So he leaves Corinth and he goes to, you must have spotted this, Ephesus, and he's there for a couple of years, or maybe a bit longer, 2 to 3 years. He says in 1910, this went on for 2 years. Anyway, he's now moved on to another significant place. What happens to Priscilla and Aquila?
They go with him.
They do. So having met up with him, they've obviously formed some kind of bond and co-worker relationship and so on. So they also go with him. But somebody now goes to Corinth, I think just after Paul has left. But certainly someone else now goes. And that is, of course... who have we read about? This is in chapter 19 again. Who's now in Corinth?
Apollos.
That's right, Apollos. So Apollos goes to Corinth, probably just after Paul has left. If Paul has left around AD 52, maybe into 53, Apollos has gone around that time. Now, Apollos was a very good speaker, so he soon attracted people around him. And one of the problems that happened was that as Paul had left and his influence diminished, that of Apollos, who turned up, began to grow. And there are other visitors to Corinth. Barnabas goes as well. He pays a visit while Paul is not there. And Peter, and presumably his wife, presumably goes with him, also visited Corinth. And Peter, of course, was a celebrity, a big star, and was also known not just for being able to preach, but also for the signs and wonders that he did. So not surprisingly, people gather around him as well. And I think we understand something of what began to happen, but certain factions began to grow up around these different things. So that's why Paul says some say they follow Apollos, some say they follow Cephas with Peter, and so on. So unfortunately, there's growing division around the different apostolic workers, which is going to cause a little bit of a problem, certainly for Paul later on. Now, Apollos eventually returns to Ephesus from Corinth, and he takes someone with him called Sosthenes, who actually was the ruler of the synagogue. And when Apollos meets up with Paul at Ephesus, he starts to say what it's like there, and he starts to tell them, starts to tell Paul about a crisis. Apollos is probably the first one to go back with some bad news. Paul is going to get lots of visitors, lots of people telling him what's happening in Corinth, and it isn't all good news. So Paul decides to write to them, which is what he does when he's left and so on. And he writes a letter which we're going to call Corinthians A, because this is not 1 Corinthians. So we're now going to have to get used to the fact that although we have got two letters to the church at Corinth in our scriptures, there are certainly more. And we'll see later how this might sort of fit together. And by the way, at the end of all this, there'll be a summary for 5 minutes of all the different comings and goings, in case you get a little bit lost or you're not taking notes all the way through. So Paul writes to them, probably sends it with Titus, and Titus therefore goes over to Corinth, and it seems that he helps the Corinthian church collect money for the Jerusalem Relief Fund, because although Paul would never take money himself from these places, he was collecting money for the church at Jerusalem. So Titus went to help with that, and then Titus returned back to Ephesus as well. And one of the problems that was gaining ground in Corinth was sexual immorality. There was a lot of Hellenism still in the thinking, the dualism, and so on. And there's going to be more and more problems that Paul is going to hear about. So let's have a look now at some more verses and see how that fits in. It's a bit patchwork, but I'm trying to give you a sort of timeline as well as some chapters and verses. So from 1 Corinthians, chapter 1, verse 11. So that's the bit where it says some from Chloe's household. Now, Chloe was one of the people in Corinth that Paul established there. So they inform him that there are quarrels, and I perhaps should have added verse 12 to that. This is where some of them say, I follow Paul, another I follow Apollos, another I follow Peter, and others I follow Christ. So that's part of the problems that's been reported back to him. And in chapter 5 and verse 1, it's reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that does not even occur amongst pagans. A man has his father's wife. In other words, commits immorality with his mother, and you're proud of this. And what I said about the nature of the place, Corinth, they thought, oh, well, this is good. This is all right. So they haven't really been converted out of that sort of behaviour yet. And in the same chapter, chapter 5, verses 9 to 13, I've written to you in my letter. Now, that must mean Corinthians A, because this is 1 Corinthians. So he had already written to them. So when you read in 1 Corinthians 5, 9, that's a reference to an earlier letter. I've written to you not to associate with sexually immoral people. And he says, now I'm writing to you that you must not associate with anyone who calls himself a brother but is sexually immoral or greedy or an idolater or a slanderer or a drunkard or a swindler. Do not even eat That must mean have fellowship or partake of the Lord's Supper with any like this. And he even goes as far as to say, expel the wicked man from among you. So there's real problems developing in the church. Paul has written about it in a lost letter. Although now's the time to tell you, because, hey, guess what? Scholars love to debate and try and sort all this out. Some people think that that lost letter might actually be contained within the two letters we actually have, and somehow later get sort of pieced together. So if you want to try and follow this through later, and you want to have a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 to chapter 7, verse 1, or indeed part of 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 1 to 10 and 22, and see if you can work out whether or not that really belongs to an earlier letter. I'm not going to debate what scholars come up with on that one. We've got this part of 1 Corinthians, and that's good enough. Anyway, Paul, to sum that up, gets lots of bad reports. Letters come sent by these various people. He's had the reports from members of Chloe's household, and may well be some of those particular people. It suggests that maybe these people actually work for Chloe, and they are sent on a journey over to Ephesus, and they tell Paul, and they, or maybe three other brothers, these three that I've mentioned here, arrive with more bad news. Some people even think that they arrived later while Paul was in the middle of writing his second letter to them, the second letter being the first letter, remember, because now the crisis has deepened and all these questions are coming back and all these bad reports, Paul immediately sets about writing again, and you get Corinthians B, which is 1 Corinthians. And to have a look now through these various verses from 1 Corinthians, and you'll see how all this sort of background and that has come together. So I'll put down 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1, chapter 8, verse 1. I'll just take you through this a little bit. chapter 7, verse 1, Paul is responding to matters that they've written about in a previous letter, which may have been a response to the first letter, Corinthians A, which was lost. So when you read chapter 7, verse 1, now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. We can't assume that's what Paul is actually saying, it is good for a man not to marry. That might be what they wrote about. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is not good for a man, it is good for a man not to marry. And then he's going to comment upon it. So, taking that little phrase, it is good for a man not to marry, out of context, people may well think, oh, well, that's what Paul says, that's his view. No, that may be what they wrote about to him, and he's going to respond to that. And then you notice in chapter 8 and verse 1, he goes on to another matter, now about food sacrificed to idols. He's going to address that particular issue with them. And in chapter 12, verse 1, the same phrase again, now about, this time spiritual gifts. So he's addressing another matter that's come to his attention. So that's why some people feel that maybe some of these reports turned up, or these other letters backwards to him, turned up while he was in the middle of trying to write to Corinthians, what we call the first letter. And so he then addresses some of these things towards the end of that letter, because it is a very long letter. So he probably was sort of writing it up as things developed. What else have I put? Chapter 16, verse 1. Again, now about, so here's another matter. For once, these chapter numbers are in a good place, have you noticed? Now about, and this is the collection for God's people. And Verse 17 is the verse that tells us that these three people, Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus, yes, arrived from Corinth to him. And 1 Corinthians 4, 17. oh, yes, this is because he's going to send Timothy. So the chances are that this letter is possibly sent with Timothy. So it's time to send someone back who, you know, Paul's really confident of and has really trained up, and someone he can trust. So for this reason, I'm sending you Timothy, my son whom I love, who is faithful in the Lord. He will remind you of my way of life in Christ Jesus, which agrees with what I teach everywhere in every church. So you've got all these problems. You've been listening to Apollos and all the rest of it. You've created factions. You're confused. You're heading into all sorts of immorality and so on. Timothy's coming, and he'll remind you what I taught. He'll remind you about the way of life that I've been explaining. So here's your chance to put yourselves right. And in 1 Corinthians 16, verses 10 and 18, that I'll put down there. Yeah, again, Timothy. If Timothy comes, see to it that he has nothing to fear while he is with you, for he is carrying on the work of the Lord just as I am. Basically, accept him as you accepted me. Receive him because he's coming instead of me, but almost as my representative. And as he says about these other guys in verse 18, such men deserve recognition. So, Paul has written to them, Corinthians B, alias 1 Corinthians, from Ephesus, around about AD 55. And let's hope that sorts everything out and Paul can be happy again. But actually, it doesn't. Paul's letter is rejected. When eventually Timothy returns from Corinth with Erastus back to where Paul is at Ephesus, he has to tell him that I wasn't welcomed. Your letter was rejected. The situation has got worse. Basically, Paul's authority is being questioned and even defied. There's some very strong-willed people in the church who are causing these problems. So Paul says, right, I've got to go. I'll make plans to go back again for another visit. But this visit seems to be delayed. And I think this is where we look at the next lot of verses. So I put here 1 Corinthians 16, 5 to 11. Now, actually, this is back in the letter that he just sent to them. So he's saying, I will come to you. So he'd made plans to go even fairly soon after he'd sent this first letter, before there's any response back again. And perhaps I'll stay with you a while. So I'm reading 1 Corinthians 16, 5 to 11. Or maybe 5 to 8 or 9. So he had planned to visit earlier. But he says, I want to spend some time with you, but I'll stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost, because a great door for effective work was opened for me, and there are many who oppose me. So he's having some problems in Ephesus. So he said, I'll come to you eventually. And in 2 Corinthians, because we've got to look ahead into the next letter to see what he was thinking and planning. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verses 15 to 17, Paul says, I plan to visit you first, so you might benefit twice. I plan to visit you on my way to Macedonia and to come back to you from Macedonia, and then to have you send me on my way to Judea. He planned all this, but it didn't happen. His earlier visit didn't happen. But he did eventually get away. and make a second visit. And what happened was that second visit was what he eventually called a painful visit. His actual second visit to them was painful. He mentioned this in the second letter that, well, 2 Corinthians is going to be the fourth one, just to, you know, get you up to speed on that one. So when he says, I made up my mind that I will not make another painful visit to you, he means a third visit, having made a second visit, okay, because the second visit that he made didn't go well. So, as I say, Timothy had come back to say that he had been rejected, the letter had been rejected. Paul says, eventually I'm going to go. But he doesn't fare any better. It becomes confrontational with them. And he leaves angry and humiliated from that second visit, the painful one. Let me just see what verses are. Okay, so 1 Corinthians 4, in that early one, he says, some of you have become arrogant, as if I'm not coming to you. I will come to you very soon, the Lord is willing. And then I will find out not only how these arrogant people are talking, but what power they have. So shall I come to you with a whip or in love and with a gentle spirit? So you decide how I should arrive by what you get up to in the meantime. So he's talking here about his intentions to come because of reports he's getting back. It just says in chapter 11, verse 34 of 1 Corinthians, and when I come, I'll give further directions. So he's keen to go when he can, but, you know, it's not just a matter of hopping onto the next plane or getting in a fast car or something. And again, he talks about in 1 Corinthians 16, 3, when I arrive. So he was always planning to go. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, jumping ahead again, he's going to write about what that was like. So when he says, this is in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 3, I wrote as I did, so that when I came, I should not be distressed by those who ought to make me rejoice. Now what he's getting at there is that he had actually, because he was delayed in his visit, he had written another letter, which we'll call Corinthians C, another one that is lost, that he wrote. So this is a third letter, and he's talking about it in this particular passage here, 2 Corinthians 2, verses 3 to 9. So he'd already made a second visit, which was a painful one. And now later, he's talking about a letter that he wrote after that visit. And he says, I wrote you out of great distress and anguish and heart, many tears, not to grieve you, but to let you know the depth of my love for you. What he's expressing here is that he'd had to write a very tough letter. And afterwards, he sort of becomes fearful that actually that letter, the tough one, may have exacerbated things. He may even think, I've done the wrong thing in sending this letter. I was too harsh with them. He's beginning to wonder. You can almost sense at this point he's very, very worried about them. He's very concerned that things are not being put right. And all these letters may not be helping. And even when he goes at this point, there's trouble. And the church now has been going for some years. Not a huge amount of time, but the time we finish this little journey through what happened. About 5 years, I think, have gone by. So it's probably 3 or 4 years old. But he's written this third letter, which is missing, except in a moment I'm going to tell you that scholars think they know where it is, but I'm not too bothered about that. But notice 2 Corinthians 7, verses 8 to 12. Even if I caused you sorrow by my letter, so that is not 1 Corinthians, which is Corinthians B, but this is the third letter, Corinthians C. 2 Corinthians is going to be Corinthians D, okay? I caused you sorrow by my letter. I don't regret it, though I did regret it. I see that my letter hurt you, but only for a little while. And he's going to explain what's going to happen. We'll look ahead to that in a minute, because we're going to see that this letter actually did work. He's going to say, "Yet now I am happy." Well, we'll see how that comes about in a minute. But that reference there is to this third letter, which Titus took to Corinth. And yes, scholars think that maybe 2 Corinthians chapters 10 to 13 might actually be Corinthians C, and it's sort of been tacked on to the end of 2 Corinthians and so on. But we'll leave the scholars to work out all that sort of thing. But the point about this letter is that he calls it a severe letter, a sorrowful letter. It was a stinging rebuke. He wondered whether he might have overdone it. In fact, by the time Titus took this letter to the church there, the church is now about 5 years old. And he may be getting quite depressed by now. Meanwhile, you see, in 2 Corinthians, he expresses how he's getting on while he's there back in Asia, in Ephesus and surrounding areas. So he talks about there the hardships and the troubles he's actually having in the province of Asia. That's in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 to 11. And also in 2 Corinthians 7, 5. It talks about being harassed at every turn, conflicts on the outside, fears within. And back in 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 to 11, he's praising God because God is comforting him. But that's because he's got sufferings and troubles and so on. So we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. So he's hearing mainly bad news from a previous place where he thought he'd done some good. He's having quite a few problems where he is at the moment. He's desperate for some good news. Really wants to hear that things are going to be on the uptake. Now, eventually, we learn in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 to 13, he goes to Troas, because the Lord has opened a door for him there. He still says, "I have no peace of mind. I was wanting to meet Titus. I was wanting him to report back what had happened recently. I want to know desperately if things have improved." But Titus wasn't there. So I still don't have peace of mind. At that point, he didn't have peace of mind about them, because there's no sign of Titus, there's no news. So Paul goes on to Macedonia, and eventually there he meets Titus. And Titus is able to report back with good news. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, from verse 6 to 16, 2 Corinthians 7, 6 to 16, want to read a bit more about that, we looked at it a moment ago about that letter was a sorrowful one, it might have hurt you. But when we came into Macedonia, we had no rest, we were housed at every turn, but we were comforted when Titus arrived, because Titus actually says good news has happened. This severe letter that you were bothered about was actually received, and people have started to take action. They started to repent. They've actually started to realize what has happened, and they've accepted what you've said. So at last, Paul is beginning to feel better about the situation. And so he writes back to them again, this time from Macedonia, around about AD 56, 57 now, as I said, about 5 or 6 years after he first went. And he writes now what we call 2 Corinthians, which is Corinthians D. Although remember, some people will think it's only the first 9 chapters of 2 Corinthians, because they think that the last chapters, 10 to 13, really were Corinthians C, but we're not bothered with that. So he sends Titus back, having been greatly encouraged by what Titus has said. So Titus is going back with another letter. There's still a few problems. And one of the problems is that there are still people who will come and preach a Jesus different from the one that I preach or have taught you about. So there's still a bit of deception going on there. Visiting teachers are still, these are visiting teachers now, they're not internal to the church at Corinth, who have now accepted Paul's authority, but there's still people turning up that have disparaged what Paul has said and are trying to preach another gospel and another Jesus. But at least he feels that the church is stronger now to cope with that. So Paul writes 2 Corinthians back to them. It's thought that this was sent again with Timothy and maybe Luke. Maybe Luke also took 2 Corinthians at the same time as Timothy. And maybe he wrote another letter, a fifth letter called Corinthians E, but that's not totally clear. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 14 and chapter 13 verse 1, so towards the end of this fourth letter, which is 2 Corinthians, chapter 12 and verse 14, chapter 13 and verse 1, he talks about making another visit, a third visit. So he's had his initial visit when he established the church and stayed 18 months. He had this painful visit when he went to try and put things right, and they rejected him. Now things have improved. He feels much happier about going again. I'm now ready to visit you for the third time, and I will not be a burden to you. And he says in verse 13, chapter 13, verse 1, this will be my third visit. And in fact, in the winter of AD 57, he left Macedonia. He spent 3 months there. And he stayed with this guy, Gaius Titius Justus, for those 3 months. Remember, he was the guy with the big house next to the synagogue where they had their meetings. And what I'm just checking up on there is that this is mentioned in Romans. Romans 16:23. Gaius, whose hospitality I and the whole church here enjoy, sends you his greetings. Why is that in Romans? Because while he was back in Corinth for the third visit, he wrote back to the church at Rome. So the letter to the church at Rome was written from Corinth in AD 57, and that's why you get reference to these people, because he is now in Corinth. So he got about, talk about Erastus again, the city's director. Timothy is with him. Timothy, my fellow worker, sends his greetings to you, as does Lucius, Jason, and Sosipater, and Tertius, who wrote down the letter, and Gaius, who I'm staying with. And that letter is sent from Corinth to Rome by Phoebe, who was in the church, not actually at Corinth, but at Kenchrea, which is the port nearby. So she was able to take that letter from there across to Rome. Right, I hope you're still there. Are you all still there? Hello, everybody?
Yes, we're here.
Right. Okay. I'm going to put some slides up. We summarise all that. Did you get lost?
A bit.
Did you follow it?
A bit, yeah.
A little bit. A little bit. The summary will probably help. Anyone got any immediate questions or comments before I do that?
How many years was it in total?
Well, if he first went in about AD 51, and then his last visit was AD 57.
So about six years.
Yeah. You see, we read these things, we think it all happened in sort of 2 weeks, don't we? Or and we forget how long it takes for them to travel around, and all the different things that can happen when you're staying there and so on. But this is a sizable chunk of Paul's ministry. Think about it. If you've got a map, it's obviously his second journey when he went there, first of all, and then his third missionary journey, which was his longest one, which included him staying in Ephesus as well. So this is right at the very heart of all Paul's journeys and ministry, and therefore some of his most significant letters. So I think it's very useful to try and put it together in this sort of little semi-autobiographical way. It wasn't all fun and games, was it?
No.
But it might be if you're there when the Isthmian games were on, but you know what I mean. It wasn't easy being a major Christian figure at that time. Any other thoughts and comments or questions before I summarise?
If people want to try and find Cenchrea, today it's called Kechris. If you look it up on Google Maps, and it's just the other side of the same isthmus.
Yes.
So it is, as you say, very, very close.
Indeed.
It's a thin isthmus.
It'll be the place you set sail from to go to Ephesus, which you did. Or indeed anywhere else, probably, in there. So that you're saying that's an existing place still in Greece, is it?
Yes.
Corinth is presumably just ruins now, is it?
No, it seems to be a very active tourist city still.
Oh, tourist city, yeah, but okay. But you think people actually still sort of live there and so on?
Yeah, there are banks open and things.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. I'll book my holiday with you eventually, don't worry. And like a travel agent, you know. Okay, do you want the summary then? And then you can
please,
still
please.
Ask them what. Okay. First visit, 18 months, from around 51 to 52. A very, very brief summary. Once he's left and moved on to Ephesus, he gets lots of bad reports. He replies in a letter, which is lost, the first one. He gets more reports back, still bad. I can go through this a second time if you really want me to, but I'll just keep going. So then he writes a second letter, which is our first letter. And that's sent from Ephesus with Timothy. He's planned a visit, a second visit, but it's delayed. Eventually he goes, and it's what he calls a painful time. So he writes another letter, the third one, the lost one, which is called the Sorrowful, Severe, Stinging Letter, which he sends with Titus. Some people think you can find it in 2 Corinthians. I put a double question mark this time, but anyway. Eventually, when he meets Titus again, Titus reports back, yeah, that's done the trick. Everything's better now. I know it's tempting to try and imagine where this missing third letter is, which is why they want it to be 2 Corinthians chapters 10 to 13. But in some ways, perhaps we haven't been told that simply because whatever was in it, it was very personal and severe for them. And it perhaps doesn't quite apply to us as these other letters do. You know, not every letter that Paul wrote was meant to be in the Bible. But by lost, it doesn't mean that, oh dear, poor us, we haven't got it, we should have. Paul wrote to several other churches as well, sent letters to them that we just don't have. We know he wrote them because he mentions them, but we don't have the letters. Anyway, after the situation improved, he writes a fourth letter, which we call 2 Corinthians, which he sends back with Titus from Macedonia. And eventually makes a third visit, which is a much happier one. Whether he writes a fifth letter or not, we ain't too sure, but who knows? He may well have done. So that's what I call the Corinthian correspondence. And hopefully now, if you read the two letters of Corinthians that we've got, some of those details will now come out of that a little bit more and fit into this scenario. So when he refers to another letter, you know it might be a letter that you haven't got. When he refers to the now for the matters you wrote about, you'll realize that they'd written to him at some point with some of the problems that they were having. And so Paul is writing in response to that. Do you want to see the summary again? I mean, can
yeah,
I?
Would you?
Yeah. Okay, let's just go back. So basically, 3 visits, 4 letters, maybe a fifth, with reports and people going backwards and forwards all the time. So the first visit for 18 months there, remember, there was some opposition from the Jews, but he had quite a bit of success, particularly amongst some of these more well-to-do people. There was a large-ish church established in the home of Gaius, next to the synagogue, 50 or 60 people maybe, many as that. So although he's had some opposition, he could say this time he's been a lot more successful. So remember, he took the Nazarite vow, did the hair bit, let his hair grow. It seems to be out of thankfulness for the success he had there. So when he left, he cut his hair, moved on to Ephesus. But then he gets all these bad reports and maybe some correspondence as people came to him. The things weren't going so well now, particularly all the divisions that were growing up with Apollos and Peter and so on. So not everybody was following Paul's original teaching. I guess there were some very strong-willed people in the church themselves who are now stirring things up and saying, oh, yes, let's follow Apollos. It wasn't Apollos or Peter were trying to create these divisions. It's what people did when these people came. So Paul replies to this in a letter, which we don't have. But the reports still keep coming back. No better. So he writes what we call 1 Corinthians to them, sends that from Ephesus. He's wanting to go back to help put things right, but he gets delayed. He has to stay at Ephesus. He says that the Lord opened doors here, so I've got to stay with my work here. I want to stay till Pentecost and so on. So his next visit is delayed. And when he does go, it's a very humiliating visit for him. They still reject him. There's still too many problems. He comes away feeling very depressed and humiliated by it all. So he writes another letter to them, which we don't have. This is the one that's severe. But that seems to do the trick, because the next report he gets back, when eventually he meets up with Titus, in Macedonia is they're repenting. They're realizing things now. They're making a change to all this. So when Paul writes his fourth letter, 2 Corinthians, it's a much happier one. But of course, don't forget, when you read, say, 2 Corinthians, you've got references to, well, I wanted to come, but I didn't. Or when I did come, it was a painful visit. Or my other letter. There's all sorts of, like any sort of letter, it's not a chronological account. It's a resume of all sorts of different things. But eventually it means that the situation has resolved itself, largely. There's still some visitors that turn up and try and preach another gospel, a different Jesus. But Paul now can go and have a happier visit, 3 months with them. And he may write another letter back to them after he's left. But we don't know what that is. And while he's back there in Corinth, he writes to Rome. So he has plenty of time to write to the church at Rome. Write to Rome, because he hasn't been there yet, of course. But remember, a lot of the Jews expelled from Rome had come to Corinth anyway, so I dare say he was quite keen to make contact with them and eventually go there. Okay, do I need to go through it another time? Do you want to see it all again? Is that enough of a framework anyway?
Yeah. It's very good.
Okay.
A lot of research gone into that, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate in that. I'm going to stop sharing now, by the way, and I can see if anybody really is there. Yes.
We are.
I was very fortunate that someone gave me a sort of outline of that, because he had done it in his church. It's a friend of mine who runs a church actually in Essex, near to where Steve is. And he showed me something that he had been doing. It's like that. That's what he did. And I thought, well, if I go through all that, I'm sure I can build that into something. And with a few more books, I'm particularly trying to find a book which takes you through, if you like, the New Testament story, so that Paul, his journeys and his letters are all sort of fitted in chronologically together. And piecing together some of these little verses here and there, which actually, when you realise where they fit, builds into the whole story, then I thought that was worth spending a bit of time doing. Because these are two very significant letters, really. We quote from them all the time, if you think about it, whether it's 1 Corinthians 13 or some of the other issues that Paul has to deal with. They seem to be quite fundamental, but it is interesting to put them into their context. So on.
Paul, you were talking about the possible other letters which may or may not be incorporated in the two that we have.
Yeah.
How do you think there was a mistake in the way the canonization went on in the first place?
I don't know. All I say is I read that scholars think, this bit of 1 Corinthians, for instance, or 2 Corinthians, reads as though it might well be what Paul is talking about.
Sure.
He had to write. I haven't followed that up because I'm not terribly interested in that. I'm happy to stick with what God has given me in my Bible.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how or who would have even thought of putting together fragments like that. I can understand saying the last few chapters of a letter might be a previous letter, like sort of an appendix put into it, and then it becomes joined to it. But I don't understand how the first one is a few verses, I can't remember what it was now, a few verses from one part of 1 Corinthians and a few verses from elsewhere.
That certainly confused me, but I can understand the 13 on 2 Corinthians.
Yeah.
But the bits that might be in and out or out is confusing.
It is. And I've mentioned it because it's part of the whole scheme of things. And the best you could do is, if you made notes of where it was, read those bits and actually think to yourself, do they fit within the flow of the whole of 1 Corinthians? And could they possibly by themselves be part of another letter. Yeah. I personally don't think it's worth bothering with, but you could do. And I'm not even too sure if 2 Corinthians 10 to 13 would really qualify as being a totally stinging, severe sort of letter. Mm. I suppose the point is that if things have been largely put right and Paul is now much happier and has written sort of nine chapters of a letter, you know, expressing that sort of thing, if the mood changes, it's very easy for people to think, oh, why is he now writing like that? Perhaps that was something he said earlier. But there we are. I mentioned it because it's part of what's out there in the literature, and if you've got scholarly books, you'll either come across that or you will find people arguing one way or the other.
Yeah. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Can I just ask, I maybe missed something here, but where does 1 Corinthians 13, where is that placed?
What's the question? Where does it what?
Where is it placed in his journeys and, you know?
Oh, I see. Well, if it's 1 Corinthians 13, then it's part of the second letter that he wrote.
Oh, it's Monica.
Okay. So, hang on, I've forgotten my own summary now. He's writing that letter in the midst of all these bad reports coming back. And don't forget he's saying now about this and now about that. So he's having to tell them about spiritual gifts, isn't it? See, 1 Corinthians 13 is not a separate chapter. Everybody loves to take that chapter out of context. It's three chapters, 12, 13 and 14. And you've got to take them together. Because the theme at this point... And 1 Corinthians 13 is not about love. Well, it is about love. It's about love within the context of spiritual gifts. Because, again, ignore the chapter numbers. Okay? And so chapter 12 is about spiritual gifts, and he goes through all that. And chapter 13 starts off, it's still about the gifts and so on, and he's going to show you the most excellent way, and the most excellent way is gifts plus love. Okay, so he's going to say in chapter 14 verse 1, follow the way of love and eagerly desire spiritual gifts, especially the gift of prophecy, and he's back to talking about all this. So he hasn't just suddenly decided, oh, I'll stop talking about spiritual gifts. Let me give my love chapter so that everybody's got something to read out at weddings or get all sorts of... he's still talking about spiritual gifts. And the most excellent way is when you combine spiritual gifts, not with all the aggro that they were causing and all the dissent and all the disputes and so on, but when, like in all these things, we need love and truth and everything acting together. So here's my little, not quite digression, but my little extra bit on love, so that you can put that back into the context, because I really want you to know the most excellent way, which is the way of love and desiring spiritual gifts. But if you start to desire spiritual gifts and there's no love, boy, is your church going to be in problems.
Oh, you're nearly preaching.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's great.
As long as it's only nearly.
It's great. You keep going.
No, that's it. Got it.
Very good.
It's back to the usual thing of, oh, well, there's a chapter, so that must be... and of course, you get to chapter 13, verse 13. These three things remain. The greatest of these is love. Let's stop there because we've done all that and so on. But no... We don't pick up a new theme until probably chapter 14 and, well, probably not even till we get to chapter 15, actually. I was looking to see if the theme changes during chapter 14, but even when we come on to new bits, like what should we say then, he's still talking about coming together with revelations, tongues, interpretation. Mm-hmm. It's not until chapter 15 that you get resurrection come in, so you get a new theme emerge. Now, brothers, I want to, and he goes on to something else there, which is, of course, the great resurrection chapter. And then chapter 16, oh, and now about the collection for God's people. So there are some clearly defined sections within this. And some of them do follow the chapter divisions, but 12, 13, 14 belong together.
Okay, can I ask a separate query not related to that?
Yes, please.
And it's just this client-patronage relationship.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't there also a sexual side, immorality, and like homosexual side?
Oh, go on. What have you come across? What have you read, shall we say?
Okay. I'll find it and send it on to you, but because it's an appendix in a book that I read.
So are you suggesting there was sexual favours as part of this?
Not always, but
there could be.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it was a way of, shall we say, I'll give you this, now you give me something in return. I will patronise you in the proper sense, not of, you know, say all sorts of things about you, but I'll offer you patronage, but you're almost buying someone, and it might just have been that they could call back some of these favours at various times. But I haven't read of anything that was particularly sexual, but as you probably know, well, a lot of that was going on at Corinth, and it often would be between the higher classes and the lower classes.
Isn't quite that sense, but I'll send you a copy of it.
Okay, thank you. Any more for any more? Because we have reached 8:30 and...
Yeah. Can I press the button for the recording?
Stop recording, yes. Yes, thank you.
It's very good. Mm-hmm. Okay. The patch.